We're going to do this last part. It's always the part that I really like because it gives everybody a chance to perform. And I think it's important that you read your poetry. And the next thing, it kind of bothers me a little bit that when you have these great readers like tonight, it's really a poetic event. And there should be like hundreds of people should listen to this. I really think that. And because it's a gift, poetry is. And I sometimes wonder, that's why I said I'm going to have an event. If you come to my poetry reading, my poetry is kind of cool. We've had fist fights at them. I've had pole dancers. It will be an event. And if you come to the poetry and you can't afford it, I will make sure I sneak you in the back door. And just with the promise that you'll help wrap Christmas presents. Okay, and there's going to be all kind of cool. Imagine, they're going to make a wine bottle with my poetry on it. They're going to charge $100 a bottle. And just think, years ago, I used to drink Tiger Rose and Thunderbird and Boone, and now it's $100. Ain't that great, huh? Cool. That you do it to all these poets. Everybody should have something special. All right, now I couldn't. Thaddeus, you're first, aren't you? Come on up here, Thaddeus. Thaddeus, I met him down this place called B-52. It's a vegan restaurant down in Lawrenceville. And I met Thaddeus, and I told him about this, and Thaddeus goes, hey, I'm a poet. I said, come on out, Thaddeus. And that place, go down to B-52 in Lawrenceville. It is great food. They make tofu scrambled eggs. It's really cool stuff. Come on over here, Rick.
I think it's okay. This is called Declaration of Intent. It's for Shannon. I have a sexual crush on all things, and this includes each and every one of you. Slow and fast objects get me, Randy. Those non-Euclidean shadows under the ants tree. Widgets, whatnots, pristine high-altitude winds. The interweaving continuum of expanding what the fuck we call ourselves just bodies. But our bodies belong to each other if we say so. Knit necklace-like of space-time. Not a single stranger known. This is called Animals Playing Persons. The solipsists among us know they aren't actually alone. It's obvious when they brush their teeth and fold their arms and break up cardboard boxes. I like the solipsists. I go inside them. It doesn't take much. It has the specific qualia of carnival confetti. The ephemeral texture bullet casings muster. And it is quite light in there, like it was as a child in your bedroom tent, snug, pajamaed, heaving around contentedly in your own heat.
Geez, Thaddeus, you're way up here. Okay, that's cool. It happens. Isn't that cool? You meet a poet down in the vegan restaurant. That's so cool, you know. That's like way cool. Michelle. Where are you at, Michelle? And guys, you guys know the rules. Two poems, two and a half poems. No Hiawatha.
Two and a half pages.
Okay, thank you. And thank you to Jimmy and Joan for another wonderful evening of poetry. This poem is about a woman named Friedel Dicker Brandeis. And she was an art teacher for about a year and a half in Terezin, which was part ghetto, part concentration camp in Czechoslovakia. And she taught art to the children there. until she and most of her students were shipped to Auschwitz and gassed. And in a time of such violence and turmoil, I think of people like her because they say something about the power of an individual and the power of art. Friedel's suitcases. She presses piles of pictures as hard as she can into the open case on her bed. Loose stacks of paper and cardboard, plain drawing paper, the backs of office forms, notices, signs, posters, ration cards, tickets, maps, blueprints, scrap. Anything she'd scavenged for her classes, then adds more and more, tests the lid, forces it down, flips the lock. Another suitcase rests on the floor, already full. One student remembers. She said that there were many colors in black and white. I did not understand that then. How could that be? I asked her again, but she did not respond. Now I understand. A boat sailing into darkness next to a brightly lit candle, a house floating by on a leaf, mountains, home, gardens, flowers, butterflies, ambulances, trains, family dinners, a bird pecking for crumbs on an empty street, a boy sick in bed, falling leaves, a menorah on a table, children holding hands, pots and pans full of food. Cedar, hearses, roosters, old men and women, mothers and fathers, transports, dogs and cats, elephants, a naked woman sitting under a tree near a man with a revolver, a vase of flowers, bunk beds. Not a single child signed their work with their concentration camp number. Next to Friedel's daybed is a chair with a small bundle and a slip of paper, her deportation order to the East, October 6, 1944. She came to Terezin years before with the same two suitcases crammed with art supplies, paints, brushes, pencils, papers, but there was never enough. Days and nights spent teaching children thin as moths, sick, half starved. Friedel herself was the medicine. To this day, the mystery of her sense of freedom remains incomprehensible to me. It flowed from her to us like an electric current. A small motherly woman with dark eyes moves quickly into a room and passes out pencils and paper. Do not think about anything. You are happy now. She and her students draw and paint on the top floor of one of the children's homes, looking out over the ramparts to the trees and mountains. Both suitcases full, she carries them up to the attic with a friend, where some friendly eye might one day find them. Of the 15,000 children who were sent from Terezin to Auschwitz, less than 100 survived. Thousands of their pictures did. In the summer of 1944, rumors of the war's end give hope. Friedel paints tempera on cardboard, flowers exploding with color, a gift from her students on her birthday. I am concentrating on painting with all imaginable intensity. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Hey, ZZ, where you at, Zeta? Come on, baby. She's like way cool, man. Come on over there. Plus, she helped campaign for my friend, McGinley. McGinley is like, she helps me with, McGinley helps me with Christmas presents and, hey, thanks for campaigning for me.
I didn't know it was an honor, really. Hey, everybody. So, yeah, I worked the polls today. First time I've done that in a while, but, you know, I sort of coming back to reality and I'm realizing it's really fucked up. So I gotta do something, you know? And, you know, Jimmy recommends McGinley and backs her, so I do too, because he's a good guy. And But it means something to go to the polls to me today in particular because, well, primary elections, for instance, today I worked in Garfield, we had less than 100 people show up, which is sad because everybody's complaining should have been there. Because the primaries filter up, and these are what really matters is this local level. And I can't help but to be impacted by it because, you know, well, my family keeps getting sent to jail. So, and judges make that difference, especially when our new attorney general's saying enforce maximum crime for, maximum penalty for all drug crimes. So, fuck him. Anyway, after picking my nephew up from county, I take him to the top of Nebo Cemetery. We split a six-pack in a blunt. He's skinny as a rail. His pants are too big. There are holes in the soles of his boots. He looks like a scarecrow. It's good to have him home. So how are you, man? It was cool, he said. Kind of like a family reunion. Three of our cousins were in there. I didn't even know we were related. Mom never talks about the family. Grandpa's a hero in jail for punching the judge that sentenced him. Mom never told me how wild Grandpa used to be. Prison life isn't so bad. I didn't mind it so much. He takes a drag on his clove cigarette, teeth bright in the moonlight. Family dimples frame his growing grin. We roll down the windows. A cloud surrounds our Camaro. Smoke floats over graves. We laugh, turn up the radio. I could tell by the way he talked that he was hooked. I knew he'd be back inside, thinking he found somewhere that he belonged. So that was one of my nephews. This is another one. They've all lived with me at various points in their life for whatever, because, you know, I'm that kind of aunt. But, you know, Andrew, this fella just got sentenced last week for 11 years on drug crime, most, and just stupidness. So this is the way the paper put him on the front page and makes an example out of our family. This is just someone that doesn't get it, calling Cornelius unbelievably ruley. State prison is where Mr. Cornelius needs to be. He exhibited a total inability to follow the rules of supervision, resulting in 11 misconducts, totaling in over 600 days in lockup, which is in the hole. So this is the poem for him. Brother Corn's in the hole again. My nephew got put in the hole again. He climbed the yard fence like King Kong, hit some guards, cried out for his woman. He went berserk after three inmates held him down, broke his jaw, breaking him in. I remember back when my uncle got out of prison. He told me, I got raped and gen pop so many times, my dick stopped getting hard. I begged to be put in the hole. Thank you.
Hey, Z, thanks, man. Thank you. Now, let me see what I can make out of this. Bri, where you at, Bri Griffith? Bree. Well, Bri, Bree, tomato, tomato. Come on, help me out here. All right. Yeah, well, I'm not the, you know, I'm kind of a dull pencil here. Come on out here.
No, you're fine. I said I like Bri. Yeah. Okay. Hello. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Thanks for staying.
I just have one poem. It's called Eating at Burgatory. My brother tells me his roommate, Richie, is leaving Pittsburgh for Los Angeles this November. Says he wants to go, but can't. I ask him why, although I already know, and I don't want to hear him say it. I wish I had just said, okay, but now it's too late. My brother is crying, and I'm waiting for the words, I want to die, to leak from his mouth like a sickness. But instead, he looks at me and says, what? I stay silent. Seriously, what? Don't you cry? He stops talking, won't even look at me, and I think, take a fucking chance. Go to California. Do something. But I don't say any of that because I know he won't listen. He won't listen. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I love your shoes. I love them. They're cool, way cool. Let's see what the hell we got here. Sarah, where you at? McNally. Come on, Sarah.
Hello, I am Sarah, and I just have one poem as well. It's one of those deals where the title is also the first line, so. My therapist tells me I need to call a psychiatrist, change my meds, and try to regulate my sleep schedule. She asks, any drug use, and I feel like an asshole when I say I smoke weed sometimes. Hope she doesn't think I'm the type to buy Huff socks. I tell her I feel guilty for not being able to help people the way I want to. My therapist tells me I need to cut back on alcohol, doesn't mention cutting back on weed, so I imagine her stoned, and I like my stoned therapist, feel safe with her. I like when she reminds me that making other people happy is not my responsibility, and I like how she laughs when I say I can't stop writing Jesus poems. I like my therapist for saying, you know that's fucked up, right? You know it's not your fault. And I like how she keeps a glass bottle filled with carbonated water. I like my therapist when she sends emails to check in and when she tells me I don't need to feel guilty. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm going to blow this one real bad. It looks like Adria? Hey, who is it? Hey, come on up here. Hey, well, that's your fault. That's your writing, my man. You can't blame me for this one.
Hi, everyone. So the other day I was skateboarding, and I thought to myself, what would my skateboard say to me if my skateboard were my friend? So this poem was born from that. Lessons from my skateboard. Loosen up and push. Be light on your feet, especially over cracks. The hard thing is easy to do when it's sunny out. You probably won't be able to grind that unwaxed curb, but you can try. Hey, look out for that nail in the crack. Think quick, move quick. You better work. This second one is titled Little Wings of Hope. When I can't remember how to spell the word beautiful, I think about the time on the school bus when Bethany said, B-A-utiful. I didn't know then that she'd be dead in 3 years. Only 18 when she took a handful of benzos, never woke up. In the wake of her death, her parents founded Little Wings of Hope, a nonprofit providing financial resources to young adults struggling with addiction. She died hours before voluntarily entering a treatment program. Her obituary says her life was cut short due to medical complications. Bethany died riding a little wing of hope, one last high. Like Phaeton, she flew the chariot too close to the sun. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Emily, where you at, Emily? Come on up here, Emily.
Hey. I'm just going to read one because it's kind of prosy, and therefore a little more long and dense. It's called Enola Gay, which is the name of the airplane that dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In the belly of the dark, the bomb is dreaming. The bomb is dreaming about a woman in a brown dress. The bomb imagines her in fits and starts. It imagines her falling into rhythm with the fits and starts of the darkness that surrounds it, which is sometimes pierced with light. The darkness is jostled and pierced in a light rhythm. The jostling rolls the bomb lightly, but only lightly, against the mechanisms that hold it. As it rolls and jostles, the bomb imagines the woman in the brown dress singing out a little rhythm. She is singing out a little song as if to soothe it, and it is soothed, rocking so very lightly in the mechanisms that hold it. The bomb does not know the woman who is singing as it does not know anyone, least of all the men who built its mechanisms. The bomb does not know sorrow, but the look on the woman's face is sorrow as she is singing, and the song is a sorrowful song about the little body that will not be soothed. The woman's voice is rising and rising, never failing. In the woman's voice is sorrow about the men who built the mechanisms that hold her from her rising and who built the unsoothable body she holds unfailing. The bomb does not know that it is dreaming as it imagines rising up from the mechanisms. It knows the singing face of the woman, and where there were mechanisms, there is a screaming, unsoothable body rising up and up and up. The bomb is rising up, and the woman's face is looking up, away, and they are light and rising. In the jostling, rolling dark, they have never dreamt of falling.